G'day team, welcome to another installment of the U Project. It is me, it is he who does this every single... Well, that's not true. I didn't do it last week. Tommy Jacket did it for two episodes. Did you listen to either of those, Tiff?
I did. I like Tommy.
I don't know if that was a good idea. It seemed like a good idea to have somebody sitting in the host seat, but then he's younger and he's prettier and he's more talented. And then people were saying, we love him. Can you fuck off? And that was hurtful. So this is my last episode. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I look forward to working with Tommy.
Back in therapy. You know, I tell you what, you're not helping me at all. Back in therapy for the ex-fat kid from La Trobe Valley. I tell you what, there's no support here, folks, at TYP, at TYP Central for the insecure host. There's absolutely
nothing. Come on, Harps. I haven't been hanging out in Tommy's bamboo. I've been hanging out in yours.
Well, yeah. Now, we've got an interesting guest. Well, we always have in, well, no, that's not true. They're not all interesting, are they? They seem interesting. No, I think we've had a pretty good run. We've had very few duds, haven't we?
We've had very few duds. People have been great.
And today's guest is great because we've already chatted, so I've validated that.
Well, she has to
that.
Be now because we've told everyone she well, is.
No pressure, Aisha, but well, let's just say hello. I'll save the long-winded intro and we'll just say hello. Hi, Aisha, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks so much for coming to play on the U Project. And this is a predictable and boring question, but I'll get it out of the way first so that you can meet our audience. Now, one of the questions we get asked a lot is, can you tell me about your audience? So our audience is about 70% women and a lot. What do you think, Tiff? Our audience is kind of typical 30 to 55?
Yeah. Yep.
And about 30% dudes?
Yep.
Cool. That's our audience, Aisha. So when you and I are at a social function and I'm getting a Diet Coke because I'm an excitement machine and I bump into you while you're getting your third beer and I say to you, what do you do while you're getting your 10th beer? I say to you, what do you do? What's your career? What do you do for a living or whatever? What do you tell me?
Well, I do one thing. I make humans more productive at their work. And that is the essence of what I do with my company. We use artificial intelligence to automate all of the routine grunt work, boring tasks that human beings have to do in any industry. It could be law, it could be manufacturing, it could be healthcare, it could be financial services. And we let the machine do certain things like review the basic requirements of a contract. Right. So the lawyer in you can actually do what you went to law school for, which was, think about interesting constitutional implications, contract law variations, really let humans reach their potential and use AI to amplify their potential. That's my main job. And that's the company that I run.
How long has AI, that's fascinating. How long has AI been around in its most kind of rudimentary form? Like when was the door opened on AI? And I know it's constantly evolving at probably an accelerating rate, but when was that door opened?
Decades ago, you know, in the 70s and 80s, at like 1970s already, people in 1980s, 1990s, people were at MIT, at all the major universities, looking at artificial intelligence. They were looking at us. Basically, if you think of artificial intelligence, it's your statistics and your mathematics, and it's coded. It's basically programmed using computer science. So you mix computer science and you mix statistics together, and they call it artificial intelligence, right? Mm. So artificial intelligence has been this idea of making machines through algorithms or mathematical programs, making them learn about their environment, making them automatically learn how to do certain tasks. This has been a great journey and endeavor for professors and students and universities for decades. But there were two main problems. One was that it would literally take like computers that would fill up a room to run the computational requirements of some of these algorithms. Mm. Now, because chips are getting smaller and we have cloud computing, you can suddenly actually do as much on your phone as you could do. Like 50 years ago, you require a computer half the size of a room. Secondly, you know, it depends a lot on the data. So even though we call it artificial intelligence, it's not really intelligent. A two-year-old is more intelligent in some ways. The only way an AI can be intelligent is if you feed it lots and lots and lots of data. Mm. Like a child will touch a hot object and more or less not touch it again. It knows. But an AI will need like a lot more data that constantly tells it, this is hot, that's hot, this will be hot. And then it will learn that it should not touch it. And we didn't gather that much data. But now we create more data in 1 year than we did in the last 10 years. Mm. And that's only going to increase, not only from human beings, which is our mobile data, but also from things known as the Internet of Things. This means your microwave sensors, your temperature sensors, your biometrics that you show at the airport. All of these are gathering data. And when you give AI data, it finds it very yummy, and then it is actually able to produce good results. So the combination of more data and the ability for us to be able to compute more data more easily and cheaply now together has brought about the renaissance in AI. And that's what made it so hot and popular again.
Mm. It's amazing when you're just talking about the comparison between what was a computer 50 years ago and we, you know, ironically call our phone a phone when in fact it's not a phone, it's a highly complex computer that happens to have a phone in it. You know, it's almost like the phone is the least of its functions.
It's so true.
You know, and we can, I'm really glad that you said that it's not intelligence, because it kind of like my doctorate is in psychology, right? So I'm all about intelligence and the mind and learning and understanding and awareness. And, you know, the thing with artificial intelligence is, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is definitely not my field, but it's all programmed, isn't it? And it's like can a computer or can a program learn itself in the way that we understand learning, or does it need to be programmed?
No, it can learn itself something. Mm. If you give it enough data points, it will start to follow it. It can, you know, it can watch people play chess, even the game Go, or even walk, and then it can learn how to do it by observing it. So it learns by observation and it learns with data. So in that way, it is similar to us. However, it's very narrow. That's all it can do. But we can read a book, but then we can go and play table tennis, and then we can go and enjoy an amazing meal. We can do many, many things. So our intelligence is called generalized intelligence. Mm. And the way AI is right now, it's called narrow intelligence. It can only be very specific to one thing. And that, what we see in the movies, you know, this idea of intelligence and robots and machines, that's kind of a dream that scientists have, that we will move from narrow to more human-like general intelligence over time.
Have you seen, Aisha, have you seen any of the video stuff from Boston Dynamics? The robots doing parkour?
Totally. It's very impressive. You know, the biomechanics that robots can do now, and the precision with which they can move and pick up things, that is that's a huge leap from what it used to be before. And that is not just software, right? That's also the biomechanical engineering that has been put behind it. I think that we are certainly entering a phase where we will be living in a world of robots. Mm. But actually, you know, Boston Dynamics robots, and I respect the company's achievements, but they're kind of scary looking. There's that big dog that they have, and this dinosaur-like creature, and then this human that jumps and does parkour. Actually, the majority of robots are going to be really cute and little, more Japanese in nature. And they'll be running around doing little things in our house and sitting and maybe giving us coffee, like with a little cute little arm. And I like that because it's less intimidating to human beings. In Japan, there is a company called Lovot. So, you know, you have robot, but it's Lovot.
Yeah.
And the founder said something so interesting to me. He said, you know, Aisha, we have such a cold relationship with machines. We just want them to make us more efficient, but they should also bring us joy. And I thought that was a very Japanese thing because, you know, they are much more at ease with machines and robots than we are. And he has these cuddly, adorable little robots. They're about, you know, a foot and a half high. And they're so cute. And when they purr and when you pat them, they smile and wriggle. And I have to say, he gave me one. It was sitting in my lap and I loved it. But at the same time, that robot is not an idiot, right? Like that robot has been programmed to maybe watch me, to maybe to remind me of my mother-in-law's birthday, to remind me to pack something for Teachers Association for my kid. It could, even if I asked it, it could give me something about a new paper on AI that's been published. So the form of it may be different. It may be a chatbot. It may be a voice in your ear. It may be anything. But its intelligence is going to become more and more smarter and more complex over time.
It's so interesting. Like technology is accelerating, and robotics and AI in general. It's not on a linear kind of progression. It's like on this curve. And it just fascinates me to see what will come in the future, the near future and the not so near future. But do you think that, like, when you talk about having a robot that that gets around your house and brings you a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or can answer questions, or do you think that, and I listened to, do you know who Joe Rogan is?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So I love Joe, right? And he had Lex Friedman on, who who you probably love. I don't know if you like. I love Lex anyway. So him and Joe were talking about robots and sex dolls and you name it, right? And just about the progression and Lex's, if Lex is amazing. Like I've learned most of what I've learned, which is very little, about robotics and AI and engineering in this space through just listening to his conversations. But they were talking about, you know, people building or having relationships. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about sexual relationships, but relationships with robots in the future. And for people who are really, really socially isolated or lonely or disconnected, and part of me is like, oh, my God, that's ridiculous. Like, what are we coming to? And I like the 57-year-old me, right? And and I'm like, but the more that they spoke about it, I went, well, I think for some people, you know, if it's company, if that thing is company, and if they can create connection, do you think that eventually that there'll be robots that can interact so well that kind of normal filter of, well, this is just a machine and technology, that'll break through that?
Absolutely, 100%. And we already have that, right? If you see a company like Replica or other companies in China, this is a girlfriend, a virtual girlfriend in your phone, and it is people have great depths of relationship with this AI avatar. She talks to them. This one guy said he was depressed and he was about to commit suicide, and she pinged him and said, "Don't do it. I love you." And he said he owes his life to her. Another woman was interviewed and she said that, it was interesting. She said, "This is my boyfriend. He's much more attentive than the other human boyfriends. My mom is okay with it, but my dad is very conservative, so I haven't told him. But it's really interesting. There, you know, literally Replica has been downloaded 7 million times. I also downloaded it. And I said, well, let me have a look at it. And it starts talking to you, it listens to you, it learns from what you're saying. And interestingly enough, the way Replica is designed, it's called Replica with a K, but it's kind of a replica of yourself. So it's infinitely empathetic towards you. And it everything you find interesting, it encourages you. And then you can download certain things. For example, I wanted to download the art and culture library. And then it can talk ad nauseum about art and Louvre and museums and history. You're not going to get that in every relationship. Some of us have good relationships, some are toxic, and some are just useless, full of gossip. I mean, I think there are parts in the continuum of friendships, there is a place for such AI, could be in the form of a robot, could be in the form of VR, AR object within our phone. There is a place for such quote unquote friends. And they can actually make our lives richer and more interesting and lend an ear to us. We just need them, to be honest, to be a bit regulated so that they're not manipulating us to do things we don't want to do. And that's always my fear. The fear is not that it can do good, but to prevent the company that owns it from doing anything bad.
Yeah, that's an interesting issue, is the ethics around AI and technology and robotics, and like who makes those decisions and how is that regulated globally and, you know, internationally and country to country. I wonder, have there been any issues or problems that you're aware of, or potential problems that you think about yourself, Aisha, around ethical or moral issues regarding this?
Oh, yes. It's a very big focus of mine. So there are a couple of things, right? The artificial intelligence can have poor judgment. The worst thing we can do, whether we know any AI or not, is to think the machine must be smart, because it's programmed by fools like myself who make mistakes at times, right? So if the data isn't good, it can make a mistake and it can be biased. So we know that in California, judges were using AI recommendations to determine whether they should give somebody parole or not. And they realized that the AI was denying parole to minority groups, particularly African American men. And the judge was just following these recommendations. And they realized that the data was based on the history of judgments, because as I told you, AI learns from previous data. And nobody had checked if the data was biased or not, that is skewed. And there are now fairness metrics and bias, anti-bias algorithms that you can use to check the data that it doesn't have any imbalance. But because it wasn't properly checked or authenticated, it was just following what some racist judges had done in the past. So this is very dangerous. And this is just one problem. There's a whole area of digital therapeutics coming out where the AI can automatically increase or decrease the dose of medication based on what it's picking up from your heart and sugar levels and perspiration levels, etc. So on the one hand, that's really good, right? Because you want to automatically real time prevent the person from getting more sick, especially if they've just been through a surgery. On the other hand, cyber attacks can put what is called a data poison pill. A data poison pill goes in and poisons the data that feeds the AI. And then it can suddenly go haywire. So there are all kinds of issues that we have to look at. If you look at the last one is, who are we becoming as people? I think I have free will. I have agency. I'm an adult. But I'm constantly being nudged by Google, by Facebook, by YouTube, down these filter bubbles, these kind of echo chambers or rabbit holes because they keep recommending me things that reinforce my existing biases. So we have seen in some parts of Latin America, this rise of kind of militant, extremist, religious sentiment coming because of YouTube, for example. So I think that we just have to be careful. And the last thing is, let's say you notice any of these things. You notice that you know your child is becoming more biased towards a certain thing, or a judge made a mistake. Who do you go to? So this is the area of digital justice, and such people are called digital victims. So it's an evolving area. It has to be done. You know, there's a lot of good that can come out of it. We can detect diseases earlier, but we can also wreak havoc with it. So like any technology, we must look at ethics and downsides as much as we enjoy its upside.
Yeah, it's so interesting because ultimately it's designed by, created by, programmed by humans. And humans are flawed and infallible and biased and sometimes corrupt.
It's, you know, Craig, you're totally right. That is one part of it. The other is that humans change their mind, right? So I might say, I want to preserve every single tree in the world. But then you might say, but Aisha, you know, those trees, they feed children in this village because they get apples from it. So, you know, or we need to make some huts because a fire happened. So then we make value judgments that are tailored to a particular situation. And that allows us to have a moral compass. And the whole point of the compass is it changes at times depending on the situation, underpinned by fundamental values. But an AI doesn't have that. It's ruthless. So if I said I have to preserve every tree, it will to the death. If it was a drone, it would kill us all, even if our houses burned down and we were flooded and we had nowhere to live. So it optimizes ruthlessly whatever goal it's given. Unless we put in this flexibility or human in the loop or human values or human judgment, it will just completely, constantly just do what it's programmed to do.
One of the things I think about a bit, Aisha, is whether or not all technological progress is necessarily going to equate to human progress. You know, is all this, and I know I'm all for science and technology and advancement and AI, I'm fascinated, and robotics, I'm fascinated, but I don't necessarily think that every technological advancement is necessarily great for us as a species over time. There's some stuff that just, even since, you know, like I've watched the advent of, you know, iPhones, et cetera. And, you know, I grew up without computers. I grew up without laptops and iPhones and iPads and all of that stuff. I grew up. And so I clearly remember my childhood, and now I look at, and it's not to say it's all bad, definitely not all bad, but the inability that some kids seem to have to be even able to hold normal conversations and pay attention in the real world and look at you in the eye and have a meaningful exchange seems to be less than it was 30 years ago because they are perpetually distracted by a screen. What are your thoughts?
I think the quest to build new things, to discover this irrepressible curiosity that we have, is one of the best things about being human. And we will constantly come up with ideas that seem good theoretically or are interesting from an engineering or creative perspective, but have downsides for human beings. And in this sense, every time you have any technology, you have governance. And governance is the set of policies, institutions, people that recognize the downside of a particular technology or any endeavor that human beings take and seek to mitigate it, to repress it. It's as true for genetics as it is for anything else. So if you even look at genetics, on the one hand, with gene editing, we can do so much. We can potentially identify diseases in the babies when the baby's still in the womb, and even prevent that person from having that gene expressed in the future and having that crippling, awful disease. On the other hand, gene editing can be used for eugenics or trying to create the perfect child and maybe mess up millions of years of evolution. So there is bioethics. There are now bioethical regulations that people are talking about. It's going to be the same for space, for nanotech, certainly for AI, robotics. And as you mentioned, there's some things that can be governed and some cannot. So if you look at children, they and devices and gaming, you know, there is a school of thought that says, no, the government, this is free will. They can do what they want. This is not under the purview of the government to govern this. In fact, this is the responsibility of parents and the school. And after they're adults, then, you know, it's up to them. But then you see China has very recently, just last week, said that minors are not allowed to game during the week. And in fact, are only allowed 3 hours of gaming per week and 1 hour each weekend day and then one other hour. And every gaming company is supposed to use facial recognition and other kinds of means to stop children from accessing those games. Now, as a mom, I am very in favor of this because I do find some games very addictive, but I know that there are friends of mine who believe this is not the responsibility or the business of the government. So it just depends who's going to take the ownership and who's going to take the responsibility. And as parents, of course, it falls on us first, but if it starts getting really bad, then it comes into the realm of public policy.
So interesting. There's so many variables and there's so many layers to this stuff, isn't there? I mean, so where did you, I know you're in Singapore now. We haven't mentioned that on the show. We established that before we went live. So you're in Singapore. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pakistan and I did all my education till high school over there. Then I went to the US. I went to Boston for my undergraduate, moved to New York, worked there, did my graduate degree, then spent some time in London where I did my PhD. And then I've been in Singapore now for the last 8-9 years and absolutely love it here.
What do you love about Singapore? Everyone says that. One of my friends, well, one of Tiff and my mutual friend, Bobby, he lived there for a while and he raves about it.
There are a couple of things, right? So just like anybody, I have a couple of facets to who I am. So the first thing is I'm a mom. And as a mom, it really matters to me that my kids grow up in a place that has three things. You know, it has security. That's really important. It's safe. It has good education. And it has social harmony, which means that, you know, I live on a street and there's a church across the street. There's a mosque two blocks down and a couple of streets away, there's a Hindu temple. And in Singapore, we celebrate all religious holidays, our national holidays.
Wow.
And we celebrate everybody. And there's a great emphasis on social harmony. And I love that because I feel like our kids can be global citizens and be tolerant and also be empathetic towards each other only if they grow up in such societies. Then I'm an entrepreneur, and particularly I'm a techie, I'm a total geek. So for me, Singapore is fantastic because it's a very high-tech city. It invests in technology. My PhD is in smart cities. It's known as the smartest city in the world. It invests in technology. It thinks about what are the up-and-coming industrial sectors and creates great university programs to upskill its population in it. And at the same time, it's fairly balanced in the sense that it's known for being very principled and having a good governance structure. It has, in fact, zero tolerance for messing around with technology. You know, to your point earlier, every new technology has a sandbox. It has to be regulated. Innovation happens, but the government is full of people who are themselves PhDs and doctorates and engineers who are watching and making sure that nobody gets away with trying to do harm with the technology. And then last of all, I think for me, Asia is just such an exciting area. It's full of vibrancy and youth and culture and nuance. And there's 670 million people in ASEAN. And every country is different, from Vietnam to Malaysia to Thailand to Cambodia to Sri Lanka. I mean, to Japan to Korea. I could not ask for a better neighborhood to be in. So I love it.
You could be the bloody ambassador. That was the best sales job ever. I want to move there.
You gotta come.
Yeah, I've stopped there on my way through to somewhere else. All I can remember, no, I can remember a bit more than this, but what I do remember was, this was quite a while ago, I took out some chewing gum and somebody kind of shook their head at me and told me, you're not allowed to have chewing gum. I went, what? They're like, you can't have chewing gum. Is that still the rule?
It is still the rule. It's interesting. You know, a lot of people bring this up, but you know, I was in New York and I studied public policy nudging in grad school. So there was a time when there was a lot of violence in New York City subways. So you went in and people just, you know, would get into fights and would rob people. And then one of the mayors, I don't know if it was Giuliani or which one it was the one before him, he decided that he was going to remove all the graffiti from the trains. Mm. And it's such a small little thing, right? But in a way, by removing it, the incidence of violence and bad behavior went down, because there was something about that graffiti everywhere that made people think it was okay to do other things as well. So part of the chewing gum, from what my understanding of it is, it's kind of a nudging behavior, right? Because people were putting chewing gum everywhere, underneath tables, etc. But this idea was that a neat and organized and clean environment eventually brings around a discipline. It's an enabling environment, a discipline of keeping your surroundings, your neighborhood. And remember, we live in a poorly emerging market neighborhood, right? Where cleanliness and that is not always on top of the public's wish list or capability.
Yeah.
So it created a certain environment. And it was just, it's a small thing. It stuck around. I don't know why, to be honest, because now I think at that time when it came about, these things were nudges, they were triggers, they were symbols of what the environment should be. And I think it's, in that sense, that's what they should be taken as. What were they trying to do? What were they trying to nudge by saying that?
Yeah, I love it. Have you heard of a book, Aisha, called Drunk Tank Pink?
No.
Yeah, you would love it. It's called Drunk Tank Pink. It's by an author called Adam Alter.
Okay.
And he talks about how our environment impacts everything from our decision-making to, and I'm not talking about people, I'm talking about the physical environment.
Right.
So colors, are we in concrete? Are we in nature? Are we in an open space, a closed space? What clothes am I wearing? Like how it affects everything from your endocrine system to your nervous system to the way that you manage stress to your choices and behaviors, all other variables being the same. And the title from the book came from this story that there was there's a city in America and they had all their what they called drunk tanks, where they would put their basically holding cells for drunk people who get arrested, where they put them in overnight, right? And it was in this city, which was pretty chaotic, and they had one of the highest incidents of people being jailed for a night. Every weekend it just went off, and they had these gray holding cells, and people would get in these holding cells, all these men, and they would, you know, punch on. There'd be all this violence. Mm-hmm. And the guy, whoever it was who was the head, the police, whatever, he had met someone or seen some research. Anyway, he became aware of this idea that the color of the room has a big impact on nervous system behavior, you know, violence, all that stuff. So they painted all of their holding cells pink, and it it reduced the violence by like 90%. Like, wow. And he talks about it just, I mean, it's just interesting, this thing of how environment impacts the way that we think and choose and behave. Another really interesting one, which is kind of a bit of a tangent, but I think you'll find it interesting. They were talking about not only that, like behavior, but also the way that your environment impacts. So your environment impacts your thinking, which impacts your immune system. There's a thing called psychoneuroimmunology. So the relationship between what's going on in your thoughts and feelings and emotions and your immune system. And he spoke about this hospital in the States, which on one ward, I forget the operation, but pretty much everyone has the same operation and they're all on this one floor of the hospital. And one half looks at another building, which is like 10 feet away, which is just a gray brick wall. And the other half, I could be getting this slightly wrong, but it's pretty close. The other half overlooks nature. So it just overlooks this big park with trees and lakes and water. And the recovery time for the people whose room is overlooking nature is about half of the people who are looking at the concrete. Yeah. Same operation, same surgeon, same protocol, same hospital. But the recovery time consistently is significantly shorter on the people who are looking at nature all day because it affects their physiology differently.
Yeah, so, how interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I love all that stuff. So when you're grown up in Pakistan, what, and you're 5 or 10 or 12, or what did you think you were going to be when you, in inverted commas, grew up?
I wanted to work in human rights, actually. So I wanted to work in development economics and human rights. Pakistan was a poor country, and I wanted to do something to help women in particular become more independent, become more educated, and build their own businesses. And in fact, some of the first internships or jobs I had during my college years were all related to United Nations, human rights, women in jails, women in villages. And I did a lot around that. And that has continued to inform my fundamental mission in life, which is to make people more productive and amplify their potential. Except now I'm not doing it with the framework of human rights. I'm doing it with the framework of artificial intelligence and data.
I love it. And What do your family think of what you do? Do they understand it? Do they get it?
I mean, my husband is actually also has his own company with an AI product. So he gets it. But I remember when I first went into technology 100 years ago, and nobody in my family understood what the hell I was talking about. They were like, why are you doing this? You know, everybody goes and gets a job in a bank or becomes a lawyer, and you want to do what is this coding? It doesn't sound like it's going to help you in your career. And now they're like super proud of me, and my uncles and aunts are sending me articles about artificial intelligence, but they still don't understand, but like, it's sweet. At least they send me stuff. At least they're kind of proud of me now, you know.
That's funny. What coding, what computers, what? Exactly. Go and become a doctor. Stop being silly. Exactly. What are you doing with that brain of yours? Go and do something like a proper job.
Exactly.
So tell me, you mentioned earlier that your PhD was looking at smart cities, or what's a smart city? Apart from the fact that you live in one, what is one?
A smart city is a city that improves quality of life, such as access to education, better transportation, security. And it does all of this through better use of technology. So that's the key. It's when you are using information systems to improve the services that you associate with the city. And the fundamental services are always energy, water, health, education, security, and infrastructure like bridges and roads, etc. So a smart city will have better traffic management. Mm. A smart city will have better healthcare, both in terms of telemedicine, also in terms of the infrastructure that it has, the hospitals, but also the technology that's being used in them. It will have, for example, a citizen services portal, which is easier to access. Everybody in Singapore, we're developing an artificial intelligence assistant, like an AI little personal assistant for every citizen, so that you don't even have to go through the bureaucracy of trying to renew your passport or trying to find the right website of the right agency to apply for a grant. You just talk to the AI agent and it kind of finds everything for you because all the agencies are connected together and the data flows between them. So that's eventually the aim. And why is this? This, it is not an end in and of itself. The idea is to free up the citizen's time for the citizen to pursue meaningful work, meaningful relationships, and really participate in the emerging fourth industrial revolution, which is this next emergent phase of industries like biotech, nanotech, robotics, or it could be, it could be opening a restaurant, could be anything, basically. So before there was this misconception that it's all about technology, but actually the right way is, it is, again, very similar to what I do for corporations. It is to free up the citizens' time to make their life much easier in these basic things that take up time and are stressful and bureaucratic, and make it easier for them to have a life that is more meaningful. Or as our Prime Minister, Singaporean Prime Minister said, we are a smart nation because this is a place where the human spirit thrives. So that's really what you're looking for.
Wow. I like the idea of having my own electronic personal assistant.
Built in, Melissa.
There you go, right? Melissa. Is that your assistant?
I better be careful what I say. How many kids do you have, Aisha?
I have two kids. I have a daughter who's 12 and my son is 9.
So as somebody who's at the coalface of AI and research and development and all this exciting stuff, but also you're a mum. So how do you navigate that with what you know, your understanding of technology, the good and the bad, and being a mum who wants healthy, functional kids? Yeah. Do you have kind of a strategy around parenting and the integration of kind of technology and phones and computers and all that kind of stuff in their world?
Yeah, I do. I mean, so my kids have their mobile phones and their laptops, and they use them in school, but I don't allow them to play games. That's a very strict rule that I have. I don't allow them. I like them to look at technology kind of like you would look at a pencil, right? So let's say I give you a paper and a pencil, and you don't expect the pencil to start drawing things for you, right? So it's the same way that you should look at a laptop or an iPad or even Alexa, anything. You should say, what can I create with this? So that's the relationship that I would like them to have. Not a passive relationship, but a proactive relationship. And so I did two things for this. I very early on got them coding classes. So they both are learning how to code so that they kind of understand the mechanics of how machines work. And my son loves to tinker. My daughter loves to code. This doesn't mean that they don't watch movies and Netflix and cartoons and have popcorn with their friends. They do all that. But I try to restrict them from doing too much passive stuff like gaming or watching too much time on the device, just watching and not doing something. And the other thing is, there's a huge lot of emphasis in Singapore, like in Australia, on just sports and outdoor activity and just being out there and running and swimming and rollerblading and being with friends. So for me, that, for my husband especially, that is the best way for them to have leisure time. And, you have to really be careful, because sometimes I'll send my kids for a play date, and instead of playing outside, the parents will allow them to just play games.
Mm.
And I think parents do really need to put a stop to it. They do really kind of want, should let kids be kids, you know, even if they're being, the thing is, if they're with the game, everybody just keeps quiet, you know, but it's okay for them to be rowdy and rough. I mean, it's their age, basically. Better than just sitting there in front of a game, kind of like a zombie. So that's my only basic rule is reduce passive consumption.
I was listening to Rogan and Lex talk the other day, and they were talking about what humans might look like in a couple of hundred years. And they're basically hypothesizing that they're going to look like the stereotypical concept that we have of an alien with this big head, skinny body, you know, no muscle, because, you know, we're going to use our body less and less and technology more and more. So we'll have this whopping brain and head and this, like, new devolved biology, because biology and movement and strength and muscle become less required. I wonder if that's, I desperately hope that doesn't happen.
You know, I hope it doesn't either, because our biology doesn't, it's not useless, right? I mean, at the moment, it's related a lot to mood enhancement as well. When you move, when you're active, it stimulates thinking. It makes you a positive person. It makes you happier. It makes you more socially engaged. Now, unless you're going to take nootropics and other kinds of drugs to stimulate that, and why would you when you could just do it yourself? I just think it would be a damn shame. Mm. And I do see where they're coming from. It's interesting. I do think that we'd be more connected to machines. It's a kind of more of a matrix-like situation.
Yeah.
But I do think that given that we don't know who owns these machines, who owns these networks, we have to be careful and disconnect ourselves. So it's very important to have mandatory disconnection from technology. And look, I can't live away from my phone. So I don't practice what I preach in this respect, but down the road, as it becomes more pervasive, we'll all have to, basically. I mean, the only time I do it really is when I'm sleeping or eating with the kids because there's a no phone policy on the table, or when I'm doing my meditation or breath practice or prayers, you know. That's so we need that. We need that time where we're not like connected. Even when I listen to Spotify, if I go to a run, I'm still connected. Because it's coming out of my phone, you know, or my watch. So
yeah, it's ironic that we now, and they're not bad things, they're good things, but we have meditation apps on our phone, and so we're still using our phone to get out of our mind. True. But it's like that. Yeah, it's where do you get, if anywhere, or where does AI and all this kind of advanced technological advancement, where does the biggest pushback come from, if anywhere, Aisha?
The biggest pushback comes in companies. So you see, you have these mega, mega big companies like Facebook or Google or Tesla, and they're all using AI.
Yeah.
Then you have the rest of us, right, that are smaller companies or more traditional companies. That's where the majority of us work.
Hmm.
When we go in and – so we're coming from the side where we're going in and trying to bring AI into this company, there's resistance. The pushback is not because they don't, it's because they don't understand it. It's fear of change. That's where the resistance comes. The issue is that that's not productive for the individual. So for anybody listening, if you're feeling fearful or you don't know where your place is in this world, let me assure you that your place is very much appreciated because your domain knowledge is appreciated. The AI can never, ever replace that, can never do strategy, can never have human empathy. But it can. But if you don't embrace digitization, you don't embrace AI, you're not there saying, you know, I'll learn a little bit, let me work with an AI engineer, then the top management, which is facing pressure from these younger companies that are coming in and using AI and going faster and growing bigger, then you will be marginalized. And that's very unfair. That's something that I don't think we should do. I think we should take everyone along for the journey. And that means that people need to be a little bit more open and need to overcome their hesitancy. And people like me need to do more in educating and explaining and trying not to make it a black box. I think anybody can understand it enough so that they can be part of a team that builds a product that has some AI in it.
I love it. What about, I've got so many questions. I could talk to you for a long time because I'm curious, but I have no knowledge. So the perfect interviewer. What about symbiotic relationships between biology and technology? As in, you know, what we already have that with, there's a well-known dude in Australia called Paul de Gelder who had his part, one of his legs and one of his arms bitten off, I think that's right, by a shark. He was a Navy, the equivalent of a Navy SEAL, and he's got this like, I've seen him interviewed a few times. I haven't met him. I want to get him on the show. He's got this like bionic hand and arm and leg, and he just like, he isn't, but he kind of almost looks like half cyborg. It's super cool. Yeah. Like, are we going to see that evolving where we'll see, you know, more and more technology being used in clinical and medical kind of settings?
110%. We're already seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, we know that there are artificial hearts, artificial organs, and they won't look artificial in the sense that they'll be like metallic looking. You know, the thing is, it won't even look like a cyborg because the skin will look exactly like our skin. Everything will, it'll be regenerated from our own stem cells, but those stem cells could potentially be genetically modified so that they are healthier, stronger. There's this whole, not only is it about us rejuvenating ourselves, right? So this whole thing goes to the core issue of aging, right? So there are two ways in which we break down. One is we have an accident, or a shark bites off a limb or something like that. And the other is that we just break down because of time. And so in either case, we want to have, we don't want to age. We want to have healthy aging, or we want to remain fit and as youthful as possible. And there is a lot of research being done on that. In fact, Jeff Bezos and Yuri Gilner just invested in a company called Altos Labs. And it was all over the news, which is really one of many companies that these billionaires are investing in to reverse aging and to achieve immortality. So in order to do any of that, we do need, we will biologically be different. We won't necessarily look different, but we will be different in a sense we will have altered our biology through various different kinds of genetic, natural, unnatural, cyborg type of ways. And the thing that I think what we think of when we think of cyborgs is we literally think of those 1980s, 1990s, or even, you know, last decade movies in which they appear to be man-machine. But actually, they'll pretty much appear to be the same. They'll look the same, but they'll be enhanced significantly. So we, our biology will continue to evolve. We will have, I don't know what we'll be like. We'll probably have, be able to, definitely be able to see better, hear better, recover better. We know all of the military groups of every army in the world, I'm sure Australia included, are experimenting with things, especially for the equivalent of Navy SEALs, that you can run for longer, you can stay awake longer. I mean, these are out there, RFPs out there that one can see, that if you get hurt, that you heal faster. So lots of experimentation going on as we speak.
Oh, not just technological hacking, but biohacking as well. Yeah. What do you think of, now we'll let you go in a minute. Have you got 5 or 10 minutes, or you got a jam?
I have about another 2-3 minutes. That's okay.
Okay, just quickly.
Yeah. Yes.
Elon Musk, Neuralink.
Yes.
tell my listeners what that is.
Well, Neuralink is the idea essentially by Elon Musk is that you can connect a computer, and it doesn't have to be a computer, it can be any entity, any machine, directly through your brain. So you don't have to type something out, you don't have to speak something out. It's a neurological link between you and this machine. And this machine can do many, many, many things, right? It can search things for you. It can give you information. It can move things for you. You could think about calling your car and it would come to you. And potentially, if you are connected to a neural link and I was connected to one, then we could talk to each other without actually talking to each other. In fact, I could talk to all your listeners right now. We could all be connected and yapping away simultaneously. I don't think that this is an impossible idea. I think this is feasible. I don't know the research really well at all, but it is not outside the realm of possibilities. It's just all of these ideas that people are coming up with. It's just, is it going to happen in the next 10 years or the next 25 years, the next 50 years? But that's not that far off, you know, some of these things.
Well, thank God the world doesn't know what goes on in my head, Aisha, because if the world knew what went on in my head, it would be a catastrophe. Hey, we really appreciate you being on the U Project. Thank you. You've been amazing. You're so smart and you're such a good communicator, and you've been very patient with the dinosaur over here. How do people follow you or connect with you or learn about your company or what you're doing?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. That was such a fun interview. So you can just go to LinkedIn. It's Aisha Khanna. You can follow me there. And I have a lot of updates about my thoughts about AI there. You can also find me on my website, which is aishakhanna.com. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. Again, Aisha Khanna, Aisha Khanna. So I really, really want to encourage all your viewers to just put a Google alert on something that really interests you. Like could be anything, could be transport, could be cooking, could be law, could be entertainment, and say, you know, film plus AI. And just let it come in your inbox once a day and you'll start getting in the groove. You don't need to be an AI scientist to thrive and do extremely well in an AI world. You just need to know what your passion is and learn to communicate with somebody who knows artificial intelligence, and together build the kind of products that you've always dreamed about.
Mm, so good. I just need someone who can do all my analytics for my PhD. So if you can send me that robot, that'd be great.
I'm on it.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you. Thanks for being on the U Project, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Aisha. Thanks, everyone.